Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Corner kick. Celtic couldn't handle Wood at the set piece. It's a brilliant header. And Cahill goes to Spinsengler. What about that? What about that? Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He's yeah! Scored. Australia got it.
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yeah, greetings to you. Episode 18 of Shim, Spider and so much more coming your way. A bumper edition today as we dissect the news that, miracle of miracles, it's finally happened. The A-League and W-League have been unbundled from FFA. What does it mean? Is this liftoff or just another false dawn? We'll assess it all with Zeljko Kalac and Craig Moore, and a little later on, one of Zeljko's charges at Zante FC, Josh Brillante, is our special guest. First of all, though, a big hello to Spider and Maury. Maury, you gave me some good quotes for a piece I wrote on Optus this week on the Rangers revival, but you're trying to be a bit cagey, aren't you? Trying not to jump the gun on the Jers title chances over there in Scotland.
Yeah, thanks, mate. I did give you some nice quotes. But yeah, look, I mean, Rangers have got off to a fantastic start, Simon. They really have. 8-0 today to Hamilton Accies at home, a huge result. But the trophies are handed out in May, which is what I said to you. We've had good starts the last couple of seasons, and after the winter break, which won't happen this year, Rangers haven't gone on with the job. But what we've seen so far this season, Simon, they're looking very strong, and have got a really deep squad, which I think has certainly put Rangers in a better position to have title success this year.
And Spider, what's the latest in lockdown in Greece and the start of the Super League 2 season? Weren't you supposed to be up and running this weekend?
Well, we were supposed to play on Sunday. We had another friendly match, which we won, which is a positive. Now, apparently, we're starting next week. So fingers crossed that we're starting next week. We will get an answer, I think, on Tuesday.
Right. It's going to be like that last minute. Brilliant. All right, let's get into it then with Simon Says, which for this week is going to be combined with Hard Talk.
Simon Says. Hard Talk.
Our Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, which has been live streaming since 2008, specialising in custom-built stream pages, pay-per-view and multi-language streaming. They can cater to large online conferences with multiple simultaneous streams and destinations, including all social media channels servicing clients Australia-wide. Go to streamgate.com.au or you can find them on Instagram. So, as we say, this segment is going to be a bit different this week. We thought the story of the unbundling of the A-League from FFA warranted an extended chat, so that's what we're going to do. In case you missed it, FFA CEO James Johnson announced late on Friday via his weekly video message that the separation had finally happened with the agreements of the governing body, the clubs and the member federations, and that the A-League and W-League would be separate entities in time for the kickoff to the new season. Intriguingly, for me at least, that news, potentially huge for the landscape here, was hidden away in the final 30 seconds of a briefing that also included details on the performance gap report and news of the Oli Roos playing two friendly games. Now, my understanding of the situation is that there's still a long-form agreement to be drawn up, but that the key terms of the unbundling were agreed to on Friday, hence the rather understated nature of the announcement. So, Maury, let's start with you. One of the key terms is that FFA becomes the regulator of the A-League, responsible for licensing, expansion, setting of criteria for access to and from the A-League, and that the A-League gets, or the clubs, get the responsibility for commercialising the game, raising investment and competition management. So is this what we've been after all these years? Is this the answer, or is this just the start?
Look, I think it is a pivotal moment for the game, but I do believe that it is just a start, Simon. I mean, FFA, with regards to controlling the licensing, expansion and the likes, is a good fit. That's what they should be doing, coach development. And the whole idea of the separation, or the drive for the clubs to separate, was so that they could realise their commercial opportunities, which was kind of done through a centralised system prior. So this gives the clubs a really good opportunity to find their feet, Simon, commercially. Look, we still need to understand a little bit more in terms of what the competition management looks like, and who is going to be a part of that committee. Because we spoke a couple of weeks ago about what was happening in England, Project Big, I believe it was called, or Big Project.
Big Project, yeah.
Yeah, so don't want to find ourselves in a situation, do we? I mean, it's a question also to you and Spider, where all of a sudden we've got the top four, five, six clubs controlling everything that happens within the game. So who is going to be between the clubs and the running of the league? You've got the judicial system, all these kind of things that would need to be taken care of. So still a lot to learn, I think, Simon, on this.
Yeah. So you're saying that you prefer an independent commission maybe to sit in between the independent A-League and the FFA?
I think that, I mean, personally to me, I think that makes sense. What do you think on that?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility as well, Simon, to be fair. I think the clubs, now that they've got the independence, I'm sure they will set something up like that. But obviously, we still don't know the big picture of it. But I'm sure something like that will be set out. And In all the countries around the world, we have the big four or five teams. In Australia, we only have 12. So we're still really going to have big four or five teams. We just want to see the smaller ones grow to actually make more of a challenge.
My concern, I think, is commercially, in the short term at least, particularly in such a different, a difficult market with COVID, and we know that the other codes dominate in Australia as well, essentially, the clubs have had that commercial freedom for quite some time. Not necessarily in legal name, but they've been given a lot more responsibility to drive the commercial framework of the game. And yet we are still 6 weeks out from the A-League season without a naming rights sponsor. That to me is a concern, and suggests that maybe it's not quite going to be as easy as maybe a few people think. Not that I think most clubs thought it was going to be easy.
There's still some challenges. You're right. And look, the times financially, COVID, look, corporate dollars are very, very difficult at the best of times to try and achieve. And now even tougher. So, yeah, interesting, Simon, definitely.
But this is what the clubs have wanted for a long time. So now the onus is on them. To go out and make it a success. So, they will be held to account on that regard. Spider, I want to ask you, in turn, this frees up the FFA, of course, from their obligations to run the A-League, or will do. James Johnson hinted now that they would be free to be innovative, and shorn of that responsibility, they'd potentially be able to turn their attentions to, for example, setting up a national second division, which is what we all want.
Yeah,
and this is something I think Dave Davutovic wrote a great article about it as well. It's something that they can really concentrate on. I think there was talks of 2022 of wanting to set that up, which is, I think, a great timeline, which we always spoke about the timelines, because it really gives them one full year now to prepare themselves for that, and to actually get the clubs who really want to participate to make sure that they're structurally ready to go into the second division.
Maury, the member federations in agreeing this deal have, as I understand it, insisted upon the FFA retaining the key principles that they agreed to back in July 2019. There still seems to me to be an element of nervousness, suspicion even, that the clubs will, once they have the power, just do what's best for them. Is that fair?
Well, what the member feds have insisted upon FFA retaining the key principles in the deal. What does that mean?
I don't know, Maury.
I think in essence, it's about the good of the overall game, not just the health of the national leagues. I think that's something that the member feds have probably quite rightly been, you know, keen to try and safeguard via the FFA.
Yeah. Well, look, my one thing is, Simon, and I've done a look. We've all seen and read the 11 principles that the FFA issued a good few months ago now. But I keep coming back to principle 7. And bear with me a little bit here. It's the whole of football approach to protecting and enhancing the game through modern, efficient and effective governance. Now, I've not heard anything, Simon, being said in this space, in terms of the unbundling is about the separation, and these are kind of things that were already in place prior to James Johnson coming in. They were already in motion. One last thing I want to read out, and for any listener that's out there, please have a read of Principle 7, because I just believe that it's a principle that's in there that's been totally ignored. COVID-19 has exposed the underlying fragilities of the current governance framework of football in Australia and highlights the urgent need for transformation towards a modernised governance framework that better serves the game today. In this light, a shift towards a one football model in line with global standards and best practice sports governance in Australia could reduce the duplication and inefficiencies that hinder the current framework and provide the game with better prospects to maximise its opportunities and protect it against threats and risks. Most importantly, it could also see football make significant cost savings, estimated to be in excess of $20 million, to improve the opportunity for more effective spending across all levels of the game. A shift to this type of model could also result in millions of dollars of new revenue via whole of game deals. Yeah. The reason why I wanted to read that, Simon, is because we still haven't addressed what role and what is going to be done with the member federations.
What should be done, in your opinion?
Well, I think that clearly we've touched on it, I don't know how many times, it needs to be streamlined. We need to have discussions about what the current member federations look like and what they should look like. We know that, you know, there's 10 different legal entities, there's 10 different chairs, there's there's 70 or so directors, 10 different strategic plans, 10 different audited accounts. The list goes on.
You still need local representation, though, don't you? I think that is clear, that they have to exist in some shape.
Yes, and Simon, we've never, ever, ever said that the member federations are no longer required. Yeah. What people are for me, ice skating around about is what is going to be done, and this is, for me, is James Johnson's job. How are you going to reduce the cost of football administration in the game in Australia, and how can those savings be then passed on to the thousands and thousands of people's families that play the game? And more importantly, for Australian football to be able to find ways to invest and develop a better future.
Spot on.
Well, let's see if James Johnson and the FFA are able to modernise or change the game's governance. I know that's certainly a priority of the governing body. Once the unbundling was resolved, which it now is. Spider, I want to ask you about Another one of the things the FFA wants to do to bridge the gap in anticipation of a national second division, and that's to expand the FFA Cup and introduce a half spot for the Champions League for the winners. On paper, that's a great incentive for the NPL clubs, but there is a catch, and I'm not sure some people are aware of this. Any clubs competing in the Champions League, indeed, even in the domestic top flight itself, you've got to adhere to the AFC club licensing regulations, which contains a lot of stuff, includes things such as proper accreditation for coaches, high performance units, stadiums, etc., etc. Are NPL clubs in a position to meet those requirements, do you think?
At the moment, I would say no.
Yeah.
But if you had a second division, I'm sure that all the second division clubs would be able to adhere to that 100%, especially having an opportunity to possibly get into a Champions League. I mean, the FFA Cup in itself, I think, has been the one fantastic thing that has been produced by the FFA. It has been an unbelievable cup. It's rejuvenated the big against smaller David versus Goliath competition. As we've seen, only an A-League club has won it so far. But the state league clubs are getting closer and closer.
Yeah, yeah. And I will just sorry, Simon. Just one final thing there. In terms of they're looking to introduce potentially a half spot for the ACL. Again, you'll know the coefficient depending on how Australian teams actually perform within the competition over the period of time. That affects the actual positions that you have to qualify for.
Yeah, your slots. Yeah.
And our recent performances in the that's there for potential change as well, isn't it? In terms of less positions.
Yep, that's true. As things stand, we could be down to one automatic spot, I think, as soon as 2023. But we shall see. There is talk, of course, of expanding the Champions League or changing the format. Who knows what will happen post-COVID. They're struggling just to get the current Champions League season finished. Just by extension of the FFA Cup that we were talking about, due to the anticipated gap in seasons between the upcoming campaign, 2020-21, and then the next one in 2021-22, which might not start until February or even March 2022. So that's a long gap between June 21 and then. The FFA reportedly looking at introducing a League Cup competition as well as the expanded FFA Cup. Maybe the top 20 NPL clubs along with the 12 A-League clubs. That'd be fun as well, Spider.
I think that's fantastic. I think all these things are fantastic. The more games you play, the more competition you get, the more of these guys that are playing in the NPL, say it's a second division at the moment all over Australia, gives them opportunities for these A-League clubs to see them. And you know what? The way I see it, the more games these players play at any level, it's a bonus for everyone.
Yeah, no, Spides, I love it, Simon. I love the concept of a new cup. In a group style formation, extra games like Spider said. Unfortunately, at some stage we were going to have a gap that needed to be filled, and I think this is a wonderful idea, and I'd love to see it happen.
I think everybody is probably in agreement with that. A couple more before we finish this particular segment. Spider, I want to ask you about Andrew Redmayne has announced that he's not going to go to Qatar to play in the Asian Champions League with Sydney FC. His wife is pregnant. He doesn't want to leave his wife. So he's going to stay in Australia. What are your thoughts on that? Not against Andrew in particular, but you know the principle of the fact that you miss a tournament because you're expecting a child.
Yeah, I know, and it's a difficult one. Yeah, I was away when both my kids were born. So, I mean, I understand it. Maury, you would understand it. In Europe, it wouldn't happen. For some reason, in Australia, it happens quite often. And I don't understand it because, realistically, these guys are professional players. They have a duty to do for the clubs that they're under contract with. And it'd be very disappointing for Sydney FC, thinking they're going to an ACL without their number one goalkeeper because possibly he could miss the birth of his child, because I've seen what Red has said. Realistically, they should be back in time. He's not sure, so he prefers not to play. But, I mean, this is just shows a little bit of the times and the way things are. It wouldn't have happened 10 years ago, 5 years ago. But the times have changed.
Spides, I remember we got a great result away to Hungary. And I'm sure you'll remember that trip. We had a bit of fun after a good result. mate, is that not... I remember Bill Collins, who unfortunately is no longer with us, having to chap your door and say, big man, that's you got to get on immediately a flight back home that your missus is going into labour.
Yeah, no, I got home and it'd been like she'd been shopping, mate. I got back home and I got home, there was a little daughter there. I said, where'd you go? To Woolworths. It was gold, Maury. As I said, it wouldn't have happened back in our days. But, yeah, I look, it's a strange one. I get it. People want to be there for the birth of their child. But I sort of say, well, the woman's given the birth, mate. You just got to come home and be there and see it. I don't know.
Man of your time, Spider. Let's move on from that. Maury, ask you about this one. This could be a long answer, but try and circumvent that if you can. FFA released the performance gap report this week. We have touched upon these issues before on the pod, identifying critical gaps in the player development pathway for Australia's national elite players. It includes, of course, the lack of high-level match minutes for youth players, the need for more games and camps for the national youth teams. These are not new issues. The proposals to alleviate this, including, and we know this already, lifting the age restrictions for A-League teams competing in the NPL to the under-23s, and for the NPL 1 men's and boys competitions involving players over 17 to be expanded to 30 games a season. Is that the right approach? And is what FCA, Football Coaches Australia President Phil Moss calls a lost generation in the early to mid-20s range, is that right, what Moss is saying?
Yeah, it is right, Simon. And I think, look, the most important thing with this, I mean, they can research themselves to their blue in their face. We've all known the reasons why we've not been developing players. It's important that everybody buys into this. And when I say everybody, I mean, you know, club coaches is also very, very important. This is not a criticism of the current national team coach, Graham Arnold, but you remember when he was at Sydney FC and he kind of said, well, I'm not going to play young players. I'm going to go with an experienced team because I'm here to win trophies. So, again, I totally understand where Arnie was coming from at that particular time. But what I'm saying is we need buy-in from everybody involved in Australian football for this to truly work, to be able to expose these younger players to many more games, to senior opportunities as quick as we can, is going to put us in a far better position moving forward over the next 5 to 20 years, Simon. So it's just important that everybody buys into it, though.
Yeah. Anything to add?
100%. Yeah, no, Maury is spot on there. And the other thing that I heard just recently, Simon, you would know better because you're back there, the under-23s Olympic team are playing two matches, right, against Sydney FC and MacArthur. And I heard that they're selling tickets for these games. Why would you sell tickets for these games? Why wouldn't you open the doors up and get as many people as you can in?
There's still restrictions get those points. I think there's still restrictions.
Okay, but why are you charging?
Well, I think because there's probably a demand to watch these games, and therefore they probably, because of the restrictions on numbers, which is 3,500, I suppose, yeah, technically they could give the tickets away for free, but how do you differentiate?
And is the MacArthur one not, Simon, the MacArthur one, is that not meant to be a closed door?
That could well be, to be honest.
I think
I know the Sydney game is I think there's 3,500 going to be admitted.
Yeah, I thought I seen something maybe about the MacArthur one potentially for whatever reason was was behind closed doors. But that's a fair enough comment, Spides, I think. But I know that small crowds, but certainly there's restrictions there as to why we can't get 20,000-30,000 in there.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I thought it was opened up to a bigger crowd than that. Sorry.
Okay, thanks for the moment, guys. So let's move overseas. London calling.
London calling.
So let's start off with the Premier League and the big game in England on Sunday, which was Manchester City against Liverpool. The two teams that are expected to challenge for the title. It ended 1-1. Jurgen Klopp calling it the toughest away game in the world. Interesting that there's a theme emerging from Klopp, from Guardiola. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has had a pop as well, saying that the scheduling of the games in England at the moment is ridiculous and that the players are, and I quote, on the edge. Is this a little bit of self-interest on behalf of the managers and this calling for five substitutes again from Guardiola and Klopp? Or do they genuinely have a point, in your opinion?
Well, maybe they were listening to our podcast about 6 weeks ago when we called that this was going to happen. So now they're actually starting to use it. Well, not use it in their defence, because it's a reality. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if you're on the weekend, both teams played Champions League. This week they had a cracking game against each other, which I was lucky enough to watch. Liverpool started off very good. Man City totally took over. De Bruyne missed a penalty. Both keepers made crucial saves. It was a top-class match for two teams so dominant. But realistically, the players are going to break sooner or later. And as we're seeing and what we've spoken about on the pod forever and a day since it started, the team, the results are so up and down. There's no consistency. I'll tell you one team that's been consistent is Tottenham. They're getting results week in, week out.
Yeah, Leicester as well. But I think Man United, obviously, Ole coming out probably the hardest, Simon, in terms of, because they played Wednesday night, they didn't get back until late Thursday because they were in Turkey, and they had a 12:30 kickoff on Saturday morning. So
that's a tough one, isn't it? That's the real tough one.
That's the real one. So look, you know, a lot more travel in Australia in terms of the Asian Champions League, less than 72 hours. With the amount of games that these players are expected to play now and the level that they're expected to play at. He lost a couple of players through injury. So I totally understand it. And it's probably something where we do need to look after the teams that are performing in Europe, because, again, no matter what major competition it is in all parts of the world, you want your teams from your country to be able to perform well.
Well, Maury, I can just tell you what I've seen this weekend, over this weekend's games. Like, I watched a lot of the Serie A matches. And for example, Inter played a massive game on Wednesday night in Donetsk. And then they come back this week and they played again. And he rotated the squad. Like, Lukaku was on the bench. So it comes down to about the managers really rotating their players and using their squads to still get results. You know, the old saying, to win a championship, you're not going to play beautiful every match. Sometimes you just got to roll the sleeves up and get a result and put some players out there. And that's what the good managers are doing.
Can I ask you guys your thoughts? I mean, you mentioned that a lot of the results are up and down this season, and you're absolutely correct. Southampton went top of the league on Friday. They're not going anymore. Now it's Leicester. You look elsewhere in Europe, Sassuolo is second in Italy. Lille and Rennes in France, second and third. Real Sociedad were top in Spain. Is this going to be a year for upsets and perhaps, you know, some different teams winning the championships across the old continent?
Well, possibly. Well, mate, you just had one there in France. Lille is second. Lille went to the San Siro on Thursday and battered Milan 3-0. And then they lost on the weekend to a little team called Brest. So it is an up-and-down season. And you're spot on, Simon. I think we could get some surprises. There's one country I don't think there will be a surprise, Germany. I think Bayern will win by 20 again.
Yeah, probably right. Spidey, you mentioned the San Siro there. Story in The Guardian this week. The Italian Heritage Authority has concluded that the San Siro has no cultural interest and can therefore be demolished, as Milan, your old club, and Inter look to find a new stadium. How does that make you feel? I think that's ludicrous.
It is crazy. And you know what? It's been a long time since I played at Milan, and there was talk of it back then, Simon, that they were going to build a new stadium for Milan and a new stadium for Inter. And I do really think it's about time both big clubs like that had their own stadium.
But to knock down the San Siro, would you be okay with that?
I know, but you know, things have to change. It's an unbelievable stadium. It's a colossus of a stadium. But I think to go forward, like Bayern Munich have done it, the big clubs have done it. Like you look at the Allianz Arena, look at the new Juventus Stadium. Everything changes. It has to be done. And two big clubs like Inter and Milan, I think, deserve to have their own stadiums.
Well, I think that would be terrible for not just the clubs in Milan, but for football fans the world over. I mean, it's, you know, for me, it's an iconic venue that obviously was a host.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of the stadiums for the World Cup in 1990. Anyway, Maury, Gianni Infantino this week saying he's got no interest in the European Super League. Why would he, of course? He's more focused on the FIFA Club World Cup expansion, which is going to feature 24 teams in 2022 held in China. We haven't spoken a lot about this in this particular part of the world, but this is a massive opportunity, isn't it, for clubs in Australia? Because if you qualified for a FIFA Club World Cup and all the money, extra money that's going to come from that, then that means that winning the Champions League is more valuable. Therefore, all of a sudden, there's a value in qualifying for the Champions League. This changes everything.
Nah, very much so, Simon. Look, it potentially could be enormous for Australian clubs. We don't have enough opportunity in Australia to really tap into huge dollars through these major tournaments, do we? The ACL costs Australian clubs at the moment. World Cup qualifiers and a World Cup appearance, depending on how far you get in the tournament before you start to realise some serious dollars. So this would be a wonderful opportunity for Australian clubs. And as you rightly say, it then becomes, at the moment, the AFC Champions League and lots of stuff, people are not really invested in it, not in terms of finances, but in terms of the feeling of the competition. But if you start to then have the benefits in terms of these kind of competitions, performances domestically that then translate to AFC that then get involved in World Club expansion competitions, big dollars comes to the game, which would be a huge bonus for Australian clubs, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know what the thing is, Maury, that's crazy. Like you said, that the AFC doesn't invest in the Champions League here, yet here in Europe, the Champions League makes big money for all clubs. So how on earth can the clubs in Asia be costing them to play in the Champions League? They need to sort that out to actually make it actually profitable and actually so clubs really strive to go to the Champions League in Asia. Mm.
Yeah, beggars belief really that it's still not been monetized to the extent in which it should have been, the Asian Champions League. Maybe that's about to change. And maybe the FIFA Club World Cup can help it change. Guys, almost out of time in this segment. One final one. Harry Kewell, has had a better week this week. They got a win against Cheltenham during the week, his Oldham Athletic team, with George Blackwood scoring his first goal for the Latex. And then they edged out Hampton and Richmond Borough in the first round of the FA Cup on Sunday by 3-2. Maybe that's just bought Harry a little bit more time.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, Harry's obviously he's come into a new job, and I think I said from day dot, and he said it as well, Simon, I'll need time. Every manager loves that. I'll need time. But look, Harry's got a team that are playing decent football. They didn't really get the rub of the green early on in the season. And it's all about football results, as a few of our coaches have also experienced, and Pete Klimovsky. You know, Muskie's doing it tough. It's about winning football matches. So, look, I think H is on the right track. I think he's got a club that are supporting him, that have seen a change in approach, in professionalism, in style of play. He's had positive reports here in the UK. And it was also nice to see George Blackwood be involved and also get his first goal. Simon, I think that will be a huge confidence booster for Georgie Blackwood. You know what it's like, Spide. You've been there as a player. You don't really feel accepted unless you feel as if you're contributing. And if you're a striker, to be able to get that first goal under your belt, that'll be huge for George.
Yeah, you know what? Oldham's one of the first teams I look at to see how they're travelling now, because I actually want them to do well. Wherever the Aussies are around the world, I actually look for their teams, Maury, because I want them to be successful, because I want to open the door again for other Aussies to get this opportunity. So we need Harry and George and, you know, us here at Xanthi and Muskie there at St. Truden and Ange over there. We need these guys to do well to open other doors.
Did you see Trent Sainsbury as well? Got a
brilliant
5-5 rear shot. Did you see the goal?
Great result.
Oh my God, it was an offside that went horribly wrong. The right fullback, mate, he was sleeping. He's still sleeping.
talking of offside, just to close, the Patrick Bamford disallowed goal for Leeds. And what is going on with football that we disallow that goal? For pointing where he wants the ball to be played.
Yes, absolutely. What's just the sleeve? The sleeve. Oh. I would like to know. I mean, you can't. The listeners can't see it, but I would like to see how many goals get scored from your shoulder to your end of your sleeve in a year. How can that be offside, mate? The game has gone potty.
Oh, but you've been in Scotland for too long, buds. Potty. I haven't heard you say that.
Right, and I have a long sleeve on.
Boys, thanks for the moment. We're going to move on to our final segment this week, and we've got another great guest waiting for us in Footballers' Lives.
Footballers' Lives.
Our guest today was born in Bundaberg in 1993, with the Bundaberg Waves being his first junior club. Later, he attended the QAS and signed for then A-League outfit Gold Coast United. In 2012, he joined Newcastle Jets for two seasons before a big move to Italy with Fiorentina. Now, getting first-team appearances was tough in Italy. He was loaned to Empoli and Como, and he had to come back home to really establish himself with Sydney FC, where he stayed 3 years and won two titles. He left the Sky Blues to join Melbourne City last season and reached the grand final again last year before heading off overseas to link up with Tony Popovich and Zeljko Kalats as part of the Australian Revolution with Xanthi FC. He's played five times for Australia and was a part of the preliminary 26-man squad for the World Cup in Russia 2 years ago. It's a big podcast welcome to Josh Brillanti. How are you, Josh?
Hey guys, yeah, I'm well, thanks. Yourself?
Very good. How's life in Greece under Popper and Spider then?
Yeah, it's been straight into things since arriving. Obviously, this past year has been a big whirlwind, so getting over here was a bit tricky, but now that I'm over here and settled, you know, hit the ground running and been straight into a tough preseason, which has been great.
Take us back to your early days in Bundaberg, Josh. I know that your dad was a big influence. I think he was involved with the Bundaberg Waves. I've got a question from Nick Meredith as well, a former Brisbane Strikers player. Were you ever coached by Raoul Cunningham?
I'm trying to think of all the past coaches.
Not a good sign if you can't remember it.
Yeah, I mean, going to, you know, I being in a country town, you're always going to regional places and the city of Brisbane to play games. So I can't really remember.
Okay. What do you remember those early days? I mean, football is obviously a part of your DNA. Was it a big part of your family growing up?
Yeah. You know, obviously having Italian heritage, dad played football and was always involved. So from as young as I can remember, I was out at the football pitch where all the games were, you know, from 7, 8 a.m. in the morning where the kids' game started to up until the night time and the senior games were. So, since I remember, I was always running around with the football at my feet and having an older brother too. I was always chasing him, trying to catch up.
Did you have a favourite team, Josh, overseas or even in Australia, I guess, when you were a kid, or favourite players?
Yeah, I did. When, back then, the English Premier League games used to be on very early in the morning in Australia, 4 or 5 a.m. And I used to get up with Dad and watched the Premier League, and my team was Chelsea. And one of my favourite players was Zola. I used to love watching him play.
Josh, I come across you early doors, mate, at Gold Coast United under Miron Blyberg and Clive Palmer. Very interesting times at Gold Coast United. What was that like to be a part of for yourself as a young player?
It was an amazing opportunity for myself. Like you said, it was a crazy times, but I look back on it thinking how lucky and grateful I am to have those opportunities, because I know it's very hard. You know, there's so many young, talented players that maybe never get the opportunity to kind of find that path to make their way through to being a professional footballer. So, you know, coming from a small country town in Queensland to going to Brisbane, Gold Coast, you know, working my way up into the first team, Gold Coast United. It was a lot of effort and a lot of work. You know, my family did so much sacrifice for me to get to this place and get opportunities. But no, there was very, very fond memories.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I've spoken to your dad as well, and obviously with your earlier days with my role at FFA and mentoring and trying to guide. Mike Mulvey, did he play a big role in your earlier career? Because he was in control at that time with the youth squad, and he was part of bringing you to Gold Coast United. Is that right?
Yeah, huge part of my development through those teenage years, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's when I initially made the move from Bundaberg to Brisbane and went to school there and joined the Queensland Academy of Sport. And yep. I think at that time they were going through a process where the football in the Queensland Academy of Sport was kind of getting pushed out. So a lot of players there were not on contracts, and it was just kind of, I was just there, not on a contract or anything, just a part of the team training every day, and, you know, worked as hard as I could to better myself. And then Mike got the opportunity to coach the Gold Coast United youth team, and he was able to bring a few players from the QAS along, and I was lucky to be one of those players, and then just, you know, tried to work hard from there to work my way up.
Joshua, we got a Twitter question from RR, who asks, if Clive Palmer didn't pull the funding, do you think that Gold Coast would have succeeded? And how good was that National Youth League winning side that you were a part of?
Yeah, it's a tough to answer. I mean, it's an unbelievable place to live. I think looking back, if you speak to past players that were in that team, you know, it would have been great to see that team continue on and have a second team in Queensland. But it just didn't work pan out that way. So hopefully in the future, you know, we're able to maybe have another team in Queensland. And to the second part of that question was our U team there was fantastic. We had a lot of players that went up into first team football, likes of Ben Halloran, Zach Anderson, Chris Harrells. I think we won it 2 or 3 years in a row there, so we had a really good team.
I guess we'll never know what could have become of that Gold Coast United club. You moved on, as we mentioned, to Newcastle Jets, where you sort of properly emerged as an A-League player. Probably a time of struggle, really, for the club. I know that they finished 8th and 7th during your two seasons there. But playing alongside the likes of Emil Heskey and Hugh Yarlins and Michael Bridges and Joel Griffiths, that must have been a good learning curve for a young footballer, as you then were.
Yeah, huge. I was at the Gold Coast United Youth. I was able to get a first team contract at Gold Coast, and you know, for me, it was all the start. I was so excited. You know, professional football. I just finished school, and I remember where I was in Gold Coast when we got that call that, you know, the club was going to fold, and I was just thinking to myself, you know, what am I going to do now? Where do I go from here? And I was lucky enough to get an opportunity at the Jets, and I think I kind of grasped that, thinking, you know, anything can happen. And like you said, to play along some of those players was a great experience for me, and you know, that helped me along the way develop as a player and a person as well, which I think is massive.
And of course, as being a kid of Italian descent, you had a good season 2013. You won Young Player of the Year, and you played against a certain Alessandro Del Piero that season as well, as you beat Sydney FC. That must have been quite special for a kid of your background, I imagine.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was a name that was brought up all the time when I was younger. So it was someone that I was very familiar with. And to be playing against him was massive. And I remember some of those games we played against him. And, you know, the talent he had was phenomenal. And I think I was just in awe playing against him. So, you know, some great memories there. And, you know, I was lucky enough to, after the game, get his signed jersey from him after the game. So that was a great
memory. You still got that, I take it.
Yeah, definitely.
talking of Italy, you then got this huge move to Fiorentina in 2014 and made your debut very quickly against Roma at the Estadio Olimpico. I had a look yesterday when I was researching our chat at the names that were involved in that fixture. I'll just reel a few of them off. You'll be aware of this, but our listeners might not be. So some of your teammates were Mario Gomez, Stefan Savic, Borja Valero, and you're up against a Roma side that includes Francesco Totti, Ashley Cole, Daniela De Rossi, Nangolan, and Miralem Pjanic. I mean, these are not small names in the world of football. And there you are, a kid from Bundaberg in your first sort of days in Serie A, and you're thrown straight in from the off. That must have been a heck of a thrill.
Yeah, it was. It all happened so quick. I remember heading over there, heading straight into pre-season camp, and we went away for about 4 to 6 weeks, you know, through South America, and had some pre-season games there. And I just took head on and straight into training and games and was doing really well. And I just didn't know what to expect being so young, and coming from football in Australia to football in Europe is such a big change. And then coming into the first game away in Roma, I was in the starting lineup. I just kind of like in the meetings leading to, I didn't have a clue that I was going to start. And I was excited. I wasn't, everyone asked me, you know, were you so nervous going out to the, into the game? But I wasn't actually that nervous. I was more excited and just ready for the occasion. And then it just all come tumbling down straight after that.
Josh, question, right? Because I've been in a foreign dressing room where the meeting that is taking place for preparation for a game happens in the normal language. I'm sitting in there. I'm assuming you're sitting in your dressing room in Italy preparing for that game. Got no idea what's being said at the team meeting. How was that translated to you?
It wasn't.
It
was weird. I didn't actually have a translator translating thing. The coach could speak a little bit of English, but didn't really speak English to me. There were some English-speaking players in the team, and I think they tried to help me as best they could, but nothing was really said. I was trying to take everything in and just try and work out what was going on. And even in the training sessions, some players would give indications of what we need to do, but no one come up to me and said, okay, this is what he said, this is what we've got to do. I just had to figure it out myself.
So, Josh, why did it go so wrong in that game? Because you got dragged, didn't you, after 35 minutes, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I think that was your only start for Fiorentina, as it turned out. What happened?
I still to this day don't know exactly why I was taken off. What happened from my memory was I lost the ball near the halfway line. Then passes, a few things, cross, come out, shot. Eventually they scored 1-0 to them. 5 minutes after that, I was taken off. Nothing was said to me after the game or ever after that. And I was just kind of waiting for someone to maybe say, you know, you made a mistake, you got taken off, fair enough. Or it was a tactical thing, or I'm not sure. It was just never spoken about. And that was the thing that probably frustrated me the most, was no one actually said.
You know, you had to sort of move on from Fiorentina to get some game time. You went to Empoli, which, again, you didn't play very much. But you did manage to get a fair few games in with Como in Serie B. Did that sort of help you readjust to life in Europe in some ways, that spell with Como?
The playing more games was great, and it was nice to be able to play matches at a good level, good players, you know, in a league where you have to fight every game. But again, I was in a position there where the start of the season, a couple months in, we had a new coach. Halfway through the season, half the team got scrapped.
Yeah.
New 50% of players come in. Then we had a new coach again. We ended up having three coaches in the one season. Team got last, I think relegated, and I think declared bankruptcy, went down to non-league. So it wasn't a nice year to finish on for me. And I think after that season, my head was kind of gone. And, you know, I just wanted to get back to enjoying playing football and wanting to win. And I think that's what sparked my move to go back to Australia.
Well, you certainly did that with Sydney. The 3 years with the Sky Blues, probably fair to say the best of your career so far, with Graham Arnold and then Steve Corrigan really getting the best out of you. And that partnership with Brendan O'Neill was one of the major key parts of Sydney's success, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Some of my most fond memories were those 3 years. You know, you play football to win trophies, and we won a handful of trophies over those few years. So the feeling within that team at that time just felt like nothing could stop us, and we were just on a ball. And I think the positivity and the culture in the team at that point was at a top level, and I think everyone could feel it and see it.
You obviously felt it was time for a change in 2019. You ended up signing for Melbourne City, but before then there was the chance to go to Korea with Pohang Steelers, but that fell through. What was the issue with that particular transfer?
I don't know where it exactly went wrong, but I think it was leading into finals times, and you know, obviously the club didn't want to let me go. And it just kind of, I'm not sure exactly where it fell through and what went wrong, but in the end, I didn't end up going. Stayed in Sydney, finished off the season, ended up winning the grand final. So it was great to finish off that year on a high. But then I think the move to Melbourne after, I think I just needed a bit more of a change and something new to keep that motivation for me to keep striving to stay at the top level. You know, I think after winning everything at Sydney, became a little bit like, you know, just easy to, things were just going to happen, and I didn't want to feel like that.
The move to Melbourne City was a big success. You got to the grand final. You also got to the FFA Cup final. You didn't win either, unfortunately, but did you enjoy your time with Melbourne City?
Yeah, I did. Again, another top club in the A-League. You know, Manchester City now own the club, and they're running the club really well. They've got top facilities there, and they're trying to do everything they can to make it a top club in the A-League in terms of the way they want to play, the resources, you know, the culture in the club, striving to win everything and be the best. So it was another great year, the last year at Melbourne City.
Mate, and you've had the opportunity then to go and work with big chops here that we've got on, big Zeljko Kalac and Popper, Zanti FC, Josh. But how different has it felt, even in the earlier stages? We touched on your move to Italy and how tough that was because probably no networks. Going to another country, but having some familiar faces. How have you found that?
Yeah, it's different. Straight away, I knew from having a little bit of experience in Italy, I knew it wasn't going to be easy. You know, you changing your whole life, moving across the world. The footballing world in Europe is so different. It's a dog-eat-dog world. So to be able to have the likes of Zeljko and Popper and some of the Aussie boys, it has made it nice and a little bit more comfortable. You know, you can speak to someone who's from the same place as you, same language. That makes it easy, that's for sure. But when it comes down to the actual football, you got to make sure that you're switched on and you're doing everything so that you're cementing your spot on the team.
I'm sure Popper will ensure that that is the case. Josh is a hard taskmaster. I'm just going to finish off with a couple of Twitter questions. This is our question of the week. $100 voucher for Outback Steakhouse goes to Ivan Hasemovic this week, who asks, Josh, over the years, you've played a few times in more advanced roles, which Eric Monberg seemed to do a couple of times last season for Melbourne City. What do you prefer, and is number six your best position? Because as Maury mentioned, you played fullback a fair few times as well.
Yeah, I always wonder about this, actually. It is a good question. Because like Craig was saying, in the younger years, I was always a midfielder when I was young. And then in that period where I went to QAS in Gold Coast, I played a lot in right fullback, which I enjoyed getting up and down the flank. Then back into midfield again. It's a tough one. I think overall, I'd probably have to say number six, but I did enjoy those periods attacking midfield and getting forward. Sometimes I feel like in a number six, I'm a bit restricted and, you know, sometimes I've got a bit more burst of energy where I want to get forward and try and get in the box and score some goals. But I'd probably have to say number six.
Is Popper going to
play? Well, that's good. You'll be nice and restricted this year.
What position to play is fine.
Nice and restricted, Maury.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Joshy, I got a couple of questions that I got to ask you, mate, that the listeners always like to hear. Mate, your favourite ground that you've played at and the biggest dungeon you've played at?
Oh, good question. Playing at Roma's Stadium was quite an atmosphere. I mean, just the buzz, just the constant buzz. Even in the warm up, the buzz around the stadium was just so loud, and the stadium was full. Being first game of the season, that was quite amazing experience. But when I went back to Sydney FC, we played against the Wanderers, first game at ANZ Stadium. That was about 62,000.
Yeah.
And that was quite a good, great experience too. You know, the derby match, first game of the season, and we spanked them 4-0 too. So
it always makes it easier to remember, doesn't it? And what's the biggest dungeon?
I've played on plenty of those. I'm just trying to think of one in particular.
Many of them, mate. Many of them.
I honestly can't think of one in particular, but there's been many cow paddocks that we've played.
Josh, by the way, I speak to Spider. He raves about the facilities at Zanti. He raves about them. Mate, is he telling Porky Pies, or is it a top setup at Zanti FC?
No, it is good. They've got a great skeleton there of everything that you want as a footballer in a club. It's a little bit old. It needs a little bit of a few things, kind of a new equipment, or, you know, maybe the showers redone, that kind of thing. But as in, they've got the gym there, they've got the offices there, they've got the two training pitches, they've got ice bars, saunas, physio rooms, big change room for the players, you know, shed for the boots, everything you want. Stadium's right there. It is a great setup.
Josh, we'll finish with this one from Nick, who asks, do you feel this move to Zanti will put you in a good place to push for a Socceroos spot? So this is the one area that we haven't sort of touched upon. You did win 5 caps for your country, but your international career has been a bit stop-start, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think that was a big part of me thinking forward. You know, I still feel like I've got plenty of years left in the tank, and I'm just kind of just getting, you know, I feel like I've still got plenty more in me. So getting back into the Socceroos mix was a big part of that. And I think being in the European shop window and the opportunity, you never know what can happen. So, again, I want to keep my mind pushing myself. And I think coming back to Europe was that opportunity for me. So I'm happy that I'm over here.
Well, Josh, we wish you all the very best with your second coming in Europe, if that's the best way to put it. And we do thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure Spider and Popper will keep you in line over there in Greece. And, good luck, mate, when the season eventually starts.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Josh, good luck, mate. And also, you said at the start, 4 to 6 weeks training camps that you had in Italy. Be careful what ideas you give Popper and Spider.
Good on you, Josh. Thanks, mate. And that is Josh Brillante, and that is us for this week. Join us again next week, same time, same place. Until then, it's bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.